Hello. Just before the pod begins, I thought I'd let you know that a game one of us has made is now out. It's called Little Kitty Big City. It's a game in which you explore a city as a cat, make friends with other stray animals, wear delightful hats, and sow chaos in your wake, as all cats do. It was written and partly designed by our very own Pip War, and has pretty good reviews so far. Find out more about it at littlekittybigcity.com. There's a list of places you can buy it and for which platforms it is available there. Anyway, on with the podcast.
Hello, and welcome to episode 434 of the Crate and Crowbar, a podcast all about video games. I'm Jamie Britton, and with me tonight is Alex Wiltshire. Hello, Alex.
Hello. Hello.
Hello. How you doing?
It's been a while.
It's been quite a while, yeah. Good to have you. Good to have you back.
Thank you. Thank you. I thought I'd join this evening.
Got any good anecdotes, or should we just jump straight into the games?
Well, like, just anecdotes in general.
Quiz shows in the 90s, remember, they'd walk over to them and they'd say, like, I believe you've got a pretty good story about something, and they'd tell the story, and then...
I'm a complete rabbit in the headlight. It's almost as if I'll never be on Wogan. I would never make a good Wogan guest, yeah.
I just long for the days when people didn't know how to talk on television. If you go on YouTube now and you can watch, you know, like vintage episodes of Stars in Their Eyes or something like that, you know. And an era where, I mean, yes, people would black up with quite a lot of abandon, and that isn't great. And the first episode I watched of it was a young, you know, white office worker from somewhere provincial, and then she was like, tonight, Matthew, I'm going to be Tina Turner. That was the first one. Which, you know, it's a lot. It's a lot to see. But she didn't know how to talk on television, and I just miss those days, because I feel like that was a sort of pre-lapsarian era of innocence.
Yeah, the kind of the innocent unpolishedness of life back then.
Yeah, everyone was just crap. It was everyone was more comfortable in their crapness.
Well, I like to think that I've preserved some of that crapness, and I'm bringing it to you here on this pod, my gift.
Speaking of craps.
Fucking hell. That's very good.
Another game played with cards for money is poker, and a roguelike version of a poker game might be something like Balatro. Which we're the only people to have played or be talking about on a podcast,
yeah,
I'm
I mean,
sure.
You know, this is, you know, like a little known game. I suppose, you know, it's an uphill struggle to get people interested in this one.
Would you like to try and describe Balatro?
It's like the Spire with a normal pack of cards. There you go.
Boom. Moving on.
Except it isn't.
The way they market it is as a roguelike card game for people who don't like those. And I think that is a bit of a magic phrase, because that is exactly how I feel about it. Mm. I'm someone who spent like just a ridiculous amount of hours like crawling my way towards win number 2 in Slay the Spire over the course of like 90 hours or something. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm doing it because I want Tom Francis to be proud of me. I think that's why.
He'll never be proud of you, Jamie.
He's never going to be proud of me. I could be there at Ascension 3000 on Slay the Spire, and Tom would just nod like curtly and ask one of his squires to move me along from his royal court. But yeah, Balatro, I think... So briefly, it uses the kind of the theming of poker, so poker hands, you know, blinds, and that's kind of it, really. That's what it brings in from poker, the hands. And I think that's its genius, right, is that because what you're building towards in this game is things that already exist, hands that already exist, that you probably even know, or even if you don't know, you can familiarize yourselves with them pretty quickly.
Yep.
And for me, that's the kind of key thing about the game, because you're essentially trying to optimize towards pre-existing sets of cards rather than trying to build your own elaborate universe machine out of things just created for this game. That's what makes Balatro to me just kind of incredible, to be honest.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean that it doesn't go like wild, you know, not very many hands into it. Like it's sort of, for all that it sort of doesn't have the abstractions of say the Spire, which asks you to believe that you're walking through levels of a dungeon and defeating monsters with cards. Like there is quite a lot of abstraction in that kind of concept. And I think a level of abstraction that my wife, who would probably actually enjoy these kinds of games, if she could get over that, just would resist. Balatro, yes, has that immediate understanding, and then just supports you as kind of the game, any individual playthrough continues, and things go wild as you transform your deck. That you have jokers which completely change the rules, or like, well, actually they don't. Do they change the rules? They adjust your play style. They change lots of things about your deck and how it works, and yeah, stuff goes wild.
Yeah, so to kind of talk through how a run in the game goes, you select one of a few decks that you can kind of unlock as you go. Each of them have a relatively minor modifier, you know, so like one more discard per turn or an extra space for a joker. But it's a fairly level playing field as you start off. And you're essentially trying to make poker hands that will score enough points to beat a small blind. So the starting one is usually 300 points you need to get. A medium blind, essentially, of 600 points for the first round, and then a big blind, which is a boss of some kind. And these carry with them, you know, debuffs and modifiers and ways of sort of screwing you over that you need to build towards and build against. And between those rounds, you get the shop, which is where the kind of magic of the game happens. You're buying your jokers, which are your sort of modifiers, but you can also add cards, remove cards, change, you know, properties of your cards themselves. It feels to me when I play it relatively compact, but that doesn't seem to diminish the possibility space. I was playing a round of it earlier where my hands were routinely scoring numbers, which were, I'm looking at the screenshot of it now, my best hand played in the run I won was 14, followed by 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 more digits. So that's just a ridiculous number. And I achieved that by having, you know, jokers that replayed all of the other jokers and multiplied my face cards by several orders of magnitude and also multiplied the first card. You know, so it was just going off in this insane loop, which was just unbelievably satisfying. Particularly as I've been banging my fucking head against this game and like really struggling with it sometimes and really getting cross. But when it goes, my God, it's just so satisfying. And it's quite hard to say goodbye to some of those, like that run where I was just demolishing everything in my path. You know, I got to the eighth blind, which is basically, you know, a win. And then it'll let you go into endless mode, which you can carry forward a bit more. But it tells you something that I was scoring, you know, trillions upon trillions of points. And by round 11 or 12, I was out. And I had to bid adieu to my, like, amazing murder pack of cards, which I was really quite attached to. Which is strange, because as you say, the theming of the game is sort of non-existent. There's plenty of theme, but there's no narrativization of it. There's a joker wanker who comes up and laughs at you when you lose a run. But beyond that, basically nothing.
Yeah. What do you think about the first few hands? Something I do find it, I mean, that feeling of attachment to a deck, which I think is quite, you know, it's basically the same as you get to a successful, say, the Spire deck as well. But when I think more than with, say, the Spire, where you've got these different character archetypes that you're going in with, and each of whom has a different deck, And that sets you in this kind of frame of mind of the kind of game you're going to have. Like if you're going to be the silent, you know the space in which you're... The run is going to like operate within and the flavor it's going to have, even though there's a wide kind of, you know, a breadth of builds you'll have within that. With Bellatro, you're not really selecting, as you said, you know, each deck comes with a minor feel, which is, yeah, plus one card swap, what's it called?
Discard,
one plus one discard, or more money at the start, or whatever like that, which becomes fairly minor very, very quickly. The actual flavor of your run doesn't actually start to emerge probably for at least three hands, I would say. Maybe the first boss, you're starting to feel it because a Joker has come up that, you know, you want to kind of, you know, build around, invest in. I find it puts me off a little bit because I want to get into the flavor faster than it does. And, You know, what kind of, or should I go a flush here? Should I not do a flush? Oh, should I go a straight? I don't know. What do you think of that bit?
So I think the opposite of that. I'm also someone who, when people talk about roguelikes and they're like, oh man, I really love the early game, you know, when you're making all of these like micro decisions, which are going to pay off hugely later, but you can't really, well, I'm sort of nodding along like that, like pretending I understand what they're talking about. Like, yeah, sure, Jobs on YouTube. I totally get what you mean by, you know, agonizing over which starting relic to take with in Slay the Spire. I totally do that too. But actually, I think Bellatro gives me that experience because even though it's quite simple, I think what the opening gambit of the game is, in that you need to score quite high early on. So you've got money, and then you basically just need to build towards whatever hand is sort of shoved in your face as the optimal one, you know, straight ahead. So if you get to the first shop and it's like, oh, I can level up full house and I can also get a Joker that will... you know, give me a plus one if there's a pair in my hand, then that obviously just tells me I need to build towards a full house. And trying to find a way to do that early on in the kind of early game, that has been behind most of my successes in that game, I think, just kind of having that strategy in mind of going in with a sort of clean slate with no sort of expectations as to what's happening, and then very much like heading in the direction the game suggests to me. And that has been, yeah, really fun. It's definitely not like you're a Slay the Spire YouTuber agonizing over which identical card to take, but it gives me those, it gives me those feels, definitely.
Yeah. It's interesting. It's also like, you know, Slay the Spire, once you're on the train, you're not going to be able to get it off it. Like, they have quite a small amount of chance to remove cards, kind of really change around the direction, the momentum you start to pick up. In Bellatro, you can actually veer quite abruptly from one kind of deck to another. Mid game, I'd say, because so much of it is defined by the jokers you have. And at any time, you can just sell them and buy more different ones. You know, if something, if a rare one comes up or a legendary, really good Joker pops up that will kind of redefine what you're going for, you can definitely take that on, you know, really quite late on. That's very interesting.
There's even a Joker that will eat other Jokers and add the sell value, which is, I'm sure, a way towards some excellently broken runs. Yeah, I think that agility in it is fantastic. Again, it's part of the kind of reason that I want to get good at Slay the Spire, but never quite managed to, because it does have that aspect that only really dawned on me because someone in the Crate and Crowbar Discord sort of explained this to me, which is in Slay the Spire, if you've got like a really sick Shiv build, you're not supposed to just make it even shivier. You have to make sure that you're sort of protecting against other forms of attack so that you can pull off your sick Shiv build properly, right? You need to optimize towards the weakness of your deck rather than the strengths. And I think Bellatro, again, gives me a kind of baby version of that. It gives me a kind of kid-friendly version of that. Not really, but you know what I mean. It kind of, it feels like a more inviting way of like suggesting to me like, oh yeah, like you're doing quite well at getting these full houses, but you're losing points in how many cards you're having to discard. Maybe you could find a way to level up your high card so that you could play a couple of those instead of discards, you know, in order to get your, you know, multiplier up. And it lays all that stuff out in a way that's legible for me, a moron, to at least understand enough to get a few wins under my belt, you know.
Yeah, that's true. And I think also, yeah, there's another pressure in it, the sort of the bosses and the, you know, it's usually just one line ability they have. And it's, I have been killed out of the blue by the old, you've only got one hand in this attempt. When I've had kind of apparently good decks, except, you know, I just couldn't assemble all of the score for that first, you know, to kill it in one go. Or the one where it selects one of the cards at random that you've got to play, and that can completely mess up if you don't have any options that aren't five card plays.
Yeah. That guy's a fucker.
Really mess you around.
I like the one that debuffs any cards that you've played in the entire ante, which is just
You know those cards you did you really well earlier in this set? Yeah. They're out.
Like, well, that was what I was doing. Those are all my cards. Can't, what do you expect from me?
And then, but I do like that. Then there's the one that said that debuffs all of your cards until you sell one of your jokers, which sometimes is fine and sometimes really is not fine.
I haven't encountered that one yet. What a nightmare that is. That's a new one. That's new to me, that one.
But it's really interesting that the kind of those challenges can feel completely different from one run to the next. One of them, like, you know, fine, I'm killing everything in one go, you know.
Yeah.
And others, that one, I just can't do it.
The one that like permanently lowers the level of your hands.
Ouch. That was
brutal.
Yeah, it really was. That was, yeah. I had one of those.
You could like limp through that one, but then the rest of your run is completely fucked.
Yeah.
It's
a really good word, agility. You know, these are all boss traits which actually use the game's agility, because, you know, these things might affect your run later on. I think it's one of the things I found really interesting and quite shocking to start with is the permanence with which the game affects your deck. So yes, you can upgrade cards and you can get rid of cards. So yeah, you're permanently changing your deck. But yeah, the idea of a boss which actively changes the aspects of your deck and your the upgrades you've applied to hands, like, whoa, okay. that's bold, but it works.
There's some really exquisite stuff it does when it's kind of UI as well, like if, for example, you have a joker which will, if you play a single card as the first hand of your round, then it will do something like make a copy of it or delete it. There's various things that do that. And like that joker will like just jiggle slightly to remind you that you can do it. Or there's lots of little bespoke animations that do stuff like that, just ways to make sure you're not missing things. They're kind of little quality of life touches, but they're done with a lot of charm and a kind of sense of humor as well, which is really great. Again, it's like a game that's like wanting you to have fun, but not telling you how to have fun. Like, it wants you to make your own fun, but it also wants, like, you know, to not just like lead you down a corridor of fun. I just think that's kind of amazing. And like the other like run based card game I've had like a lot of fun with is Monster Train, which I think is like a brilliant game in its own right. But that game has like several games worth of like ridiculous theming that goes along with it. And I think that is like definitely a valid way to make one of these games. And I think maybe the game we're going to talk about next is to that point as well. But like the fact that Balatro removes all character and narrative and all of those aspects and yet still feels really alive and full of personality, I just think is, yeah, I just don't have enough superlatives to say about it, really. I think it's an absolute triumph.
What speed do you play it on?
Oh, I'm just looking. Let me look. Because there's that little trick you can do where if you can't see one of your cards because it's hidden, if the boss like hides your hand when it's drawn or something like that, you can do the thing where you use a Zodiac card on them and it will briefly turn them round so you can have a little look-see at what
a Zodiac, what's what? There. Oh, this is new to me.
Are they called the Zodiac cards? The ones that just modify cards that you can play.
Okay.
But if you use them
while... the tarot or the...
The tarot, yeah. The tarot, I guess. Yeah. Yeah, the tarot cards. So if you use those on cards which are hidden, because they've been drawn hidden or whatever, they will briefly turn around when you use those on it. So it's quite a useful way to get a little cheeky peek.
That's really... Because you can also do card ordering, because there are two ways that you can automatically... Like, the game will automatically order the cards in your hand. And one of them is by suit and the other is by numerically. And so you can make fairly informed guesses as to what those face-down cards are in those cases as well. It's very interesting. Like, to kind of... To make the secrets discernible is a fun thing to do.
Yeah, and it's like something that, not to like slander Slay the Spire, but it's something like that game would never do, right? Like, that game wants to be a locked door to you, and it wants you to find a key. But with Balatro, like, it's playful. It wants you to kind of be a bit sneaky sometimes as well. I play
it's
on.
A it's a joker. It's a joker. There you go. It's the little cheeky guy.
It's a cheeky guy. I play on Game Speed 4, which I think is the fastest speed.
Oh, yeah, classy. Yeah,
I don't have time. I don't have time in my busy life for cards to fly around. Although someone at work was like, I posted a screenshot of one of my ridiculous calls. He's like, why have you turned the CRT filter off? Turn it back on. I was like, oh, yes, sir.
My goodness. So the purists have come out. So playing through Balatro, one of the strange things my personality does in the face of playing a game that I enjoy is, of course, to download a completely different game in the same genre and play that instead.
Well, it's why everyone's now playing the old Assassin's Creed pirate game, despite the fact that the new one's come out.
Yes.
Everyone's like, well, this looks interesting, but have you played Assassin's Creed Black Flag from... a decade ago.
Which appears to be better, but okay, yes. Yeah.
Sorry, I interrupted.
No. I've been playing Cobalt Core because I hadn't gotten around to it, and it kind of jogged me into thinking, right, I really want to try that out. And honestly, I can't really talk about it that much because I haven't played that much of it. I've won it maybe twice, but it doesn't seem to be that difficult, or at least playing it on its sort of standard difficulty level at the start is reasonably easy, and I think I like it a lot. Cobalt Core is a purer Spire, straight the Slay the Spire, like, in the sense that you are playing cards with abilities against an enemy, essentially. However, the theming and all the extra bits and pieces that the game, how the game works, are all are very different. We are a spaceship. I think that we are the spaceship. The cards that you have are defined against, or like that have colors and sort of are in decks that are ascribed to three crew members on the ship. So one crew member might be good at weapons, so their cards are all about weapon, shooting stuff well. Another might be about shield, and another one might be about dodging. Because you are a ship, and not only are you attacking stuff, but you're also having to line up your guns with an opposing ship on a kind of a grid. Well, like on swim lanes. So you're kind of moving left and right. The other ship is moving left and right. Your gun is in a specific place, and you're kind of line up that gun with the place on the other on the enemy ship that you want to hit. You know where the enemy ship is going to be shooting from on its turn after yours, so you know where to avoid being, so that the ship doesn't get hit. You're playing cards which add shield. Which will defend, which will negate a certain amount of damage. You are adding dodge sort of currency to your ship so that you can move around, and you're firing, and all your cards are all defining each of those actions. And it is balletic, I suppose. It's like, it feels very much this game of give and take, where you are hiding and you are attacking and you are waiting and you are going onto the back foot and then onto the forefoot. And it's so I suppose more like fencing than ballet. That's fencing. But I think I actually like it more than Bellatro. It's not really fair to actually compare them too closely, but I'm having a richer time with it actually, because there's so much logical depth to it. You know, where in Bellatro you're kind of playing around with eventually huge numbers and mad cards and kind of effects on cards and sort of dizzying sort of, you know, cause and effect of decisions that you've made over the course of the game. And this one, like, you are a ship and you are dodging bullets and you are sending out bullets and you are, you know, it's, I like that crunchiness. Have you played Cobalt Core yet, Jamie?
No, I haven't played it at all. Like, it's one of those ones that's come up a fair bit. But yeah, I've managed to kind of completely miss it. Looks lovely. I'm just looking at some footage of it now. It's gorgeous art style. I can tell that it's one of those games, a bit like Bellatro actually, where the screen vibrates very satisfyingly every time something happens.
Very post-Vlambeer, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, that's making me sort of want to buy it straight away and start playing it. I also understand, I've been led to believe that it has a rather spectacular soundtrack as well.
People say, yes, because the music is great as well. Yeah. It's got a real sense of fun. There's much more, there is story in it as well, where in each run, your characters are talking throughout the, you know, just single line bits of script, kind of, you know, responding to things that are happening, which gives a little bit of life. But then also, they are responding to, or they're offering bits of storyline when you win a run. And because of their reaction to the kind of time loopy thing that's kind of happening in the game story, which is, you know, it's all really light stuff played sweetly and with lots of fun. But it's an extra little dose of gift, I suppose, you know, reward for doing, you know, getting through a run and starting again. Because this game, unlike Bellatro, you know, it ends when you've completed it, you know, where Bellatro allows you just to continue playing until you know, it's kind of game of exponential numbers kind of just sort of beats you. This one kind of, you're back round and you start again from scratch. Yeah, I'm not really ready to talk about it any more for now, but yes, lovely, 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 lovely game.
I mean, I will say that Bellatro has had such an effect on me that I've, you know, it's slightly Tetris affected me, you know. I kind of, I'm listening to you talk about Cobalt Core and I'm thinking, yeah, but like...
Yeah, but it's not, yeah. It's
but
not
how do you make, right. How do you make the flushes? Like, is there a flush in there? Because in Bellatro there's flushes. Like, I do think, I can't quite remember the last time a sort of a cerebral puzzly game like Bellatro quite got inside me so much. I might have to find a way to, you know, get its hooks out of me at some point, because yeah, I do slightly think it might be sapping my soul out. And well, as a sort of refresher, maybe I'll talk a little bit about Deep Rock Survivor, which is lovely. So this is a Vampire Survivor like game from the same team behind Deep Rock Galactic.
Oh, goodness me. Yes, okay. Yep, yep, yep.
And I think out of all the ones I've played quite a few of the vamp likes. And yeah, I think out of all of the ones I've played, it's the most successful. So, I mean, it almost doesn't bear describing what happens in this game, because it is so much, you know, very much to the genre conventions. So, but to be brief about it, you play as, you know, one of several character classes. Your job is to go down. I mean, this is actually, this isn't what I'm describing is actually unique to this game, and it's theming, so it's worth describing. You need to go down several layers whilst killing monsters and collecting XP from the dead monsters to kind of level up your weapons and abilities, passive and otherwise, and make your way down to a boss at the bottom of the kind of dungeon, for all intents and purposes, who you then need to kill, and that will sort of win you your run and win you lots of currency. It's all done through the theming of Deep Rock Galactic, which, if you haven't played, I really recommend. It's one of my favourite games ever, and I think Helldivers 2 recently has eaten quite a lot of its cake. I mean, they've been joking with each other on Twitter, the teams behind them, but I do think that a lot of the kind of thrills and spills you get in Helldivers are things that I've definitely experienced in Deep Rock Galactic 2. But yeah, using the theming of that, so there's dwarfs who are mining a vast mineral-rich planet called, I think, Hoxes, who have these kind of ridiculous melding of kind of fantasy dwarf tropes and sci-fi. And you're using... What's really lovely about it is if you're familiar with Deep Rock Galactic, then it's all the same weapons, all the same voice actors, lots of the same barks even, lots of the same enemies, put to this entirely different purpose, which is just very, very satisfying. And like Balatro, it's all about, you know, getting overpowered, building yourself up to be as kind of powerful as possible, making, you know, many, many decisions throughout the course of a run in order to, you know, build towards a specific build idea or just survive. And then depending on how you do, you unlock new weapons, new abilities, new character classes, all that kind of stuff. The thing that really sets it apart is the mining. So this is the thing that makes it a bit unique and a bit special, I think, amongst the other survivor type games, in that the level that you spawn into is covered in rock, and you can mine through the rock as default, and you can speed up your ability to mine with various upgrades. But that means you have a certain amount of ability to manage the space. So you can build choke points for yourself. You can build sort of safe zones for yourself. You can, you know, focus more on one kind of enemy. You could use the enemies that kind of do a big explosion when they go near you in order to wipe out a big quadrant of enemies on the map. And just generally, like, that ability to manage your space gives the game its own unique flavor, which again is really compulsive. As I say, Balatro has taken over all aspects of my life, including eating and drinking, but Deep Rock Survivor before that was very compulsive as well, in that kind of one more run kind of way. And yeah, it's just the tone of the game is always, as with Deep Rock Galactic, just one of deep friendliness and amiability. You know, they really tried to build the personality of these kind of drunken, like, dwarfs and the kind of comradeship between them into this universe. And it really works in this game as well, even though it's just like solo play. It still manages to retain that sense of warmth and good humor and sort of ever so slight bawdiness, which I think is, yeah, a really unique kind of character to those games. And yeah, it's just... It's really nice to see a kind of, you know, AA indie type studio, you know, trying something else in the kind of indie space and sort of really knocking out the park. I know that stuff is like can be fraught with peril to kind of pivot away or take a kind of side route off from the big game you make. But actually, I think, you know, it's a really good example of how you can reuse assets and characters and theming and stuff like that and apply it to a, you know, pre-existing genre, and for it not to feel like a cash-in or a cash grab, but something that's actually conceived with a lot of care and attention, and, you know, doesn't feel in any way cynical. It just feels like a bunch of people having a lot of fun trying something at once new and familiar.
Yeah. How does it manage the sort of the longer game? Like, you know, as you go into a run, like one of the fun things about Vampire Survivors is that you often go in with an intention in mind. Oh, I want to unlock this. I want to go and try out this, that. You know, I noticed this on a previous run. Is there something to it? Does it have elements of that which kind of encourage you into a new run and give a structure and kind of, and sort of a mission to do?
So I would say no, not that I've noticed. That doesn't necessarily mean that aspect isn't there. It might just be further into the game than I've got. But at the moment, I would say that the secrets aspect of Vampire Survivor, which I think is, you know, it's really wonderful with Vampire Survivor that you can boot it up, you know, after not playing it for a few months, and there's a whole bunch of new mad shit that he's added that wasn't there before, you know, regardless of whether you bought the DLC or not. There's like, oh, he's added a whole new thing in the menu. and I think, you know, that's probably down the road for this game. At the moment, I would say that the missions do feel a little bit myopic, in that you kind of, you know, you're just sort of heading for a destination. But yeah, there may be more secrets in there. I'm sure they're coming if they're not. One thing it does have is a nice diversity of biomes in there. You know, the flavors of Zone are nicely different in that kind of Vampire Survivor way, and they add kind of different modifiers. Like there's one that's full of sort of thorns and creepers and things like that, which kind of makes the mining have a different speed and texture to it. And each level does have a little mini mission involving, you know, collecting a certain type of resource, which, yeah, it does kind of, you realize very quickly that you sort of need to do all of them. But as yet, it doesn't have the mystery of a Vampire Survivor type game. It's hard to imagine many games being able to achieve that level of mystery that Vampire Survivors does, just because it's so mad with all the stuff that's in there.
Yeah, and it's sort of, and it's always surprising because you kind of, you know, mentally write it off as being sort of, because it's, especially before that the engine changed, it was such an ugly, janky feeling kind of thing with sort of, you know, how could there be much going on under this? And yeah, to see that kind of sort of denied was fun.
Well, it's funny with that game because, you know, as I say, like it might be a peerless pick up every few months to see what's going on in it type game. And I was playing it a few months ago and suddenly I, you know, the game rolled credits. I realized I'd sort of, over the course of a couple of years, finally sort of stumbled my way to the sort of quote unquote ending of the game. You know, it was quite moving, you know, it was quite sweet. I was like, oh, it's nice of the game to show me some credits. You're like,
always very charming.
Yeah.
That leads me neatly to the other game I wanted to talk about, because I've talked about it a few times in the distant past on the pod, but after 5 long years, I finished Red Dead Redemption 2. I got to the end credits on the single player game, and goodness me, what a long game that is.
I notice you're sort of playing in real time.
Yeah, it probably is actually pretty much real time, yeah. Its epic span is almost as epic as my life has gone on around it.
Absolutely, yeah. Plus all that time you spent as a cowboy, yeah, it must feel pretty relevant.
Yeah. The West, of course. West of England, yes. the sodden West. Spoilers from here on in, because I'm just going to go ahead and just talk about exactly what happens at the end of the game, because like surely everyone else who was going to finish it has finished it by now, and I'm the only one that's going to be lagging. Interestingly, I've been playing on PlayStation. The trophies, they give you a percentage level of how many people get the kind of end or the trophies. The end single player trophies are being gathered 37%. Of players, which I don't know what that means, because in some terms, like, that's actually quite high for completing a game, you know, given that it also has a large online mode, which a lot of people I would imagine only play that and didn't really bother finishing the single player game, and it's a very long game, so that's probably higher than I thought it would be. But yeah, that's an aside. It's a game that didn't want to end in that Rockstar way.
Yeah.
Rockstar are a funny bunch. Really, really fun. Like the way they do their stories and the pride with which the pride they have in themselves, it's really interesting. And they're so confident in their ability. sometimes misplaced. It's a company that really, you know, so Red Dead Redemption 2 has one hell of an epilogue. And I had not really read much about the ending of the game. I didn't know until it happened that the main character you're playing, oh, it's quite been quite a while since I was him, so I've forgotten his name.
Arthur.
Arthur Cowboy Man. Yeah.
Name's Man. Arthur Cowboy Man.
He dies. And because you kind of know that because you spend hours. I spent days. I spent months with him on at the edge of death, coughing his guts up because he has tuberculosis, and he spends a lot of missions and therefore months of my life just coughing up his guts. And you know this is an open world game, so you kind of want to run everywhere because you've got a lot of ground to cover. Even getting on horses, kind of, you know, there's an element of effort to it. And he's grunting and coughing and kind of groaning, and the effort with everything that happens. He's setting down camp, it's raining, and he's wearing clothes. The game sort of tells you how warm or cold your character is depending on the clothes you've worn. And I never used to fuck about with the clothes, but I would happily go from cold climates to warm climates. And there's Arthur just suffering so profoundly throughout all of my actions, kind of wheezing and freezing and starving. He was very emaciated. I didn't eat enough food for a long time as well. I tortured Arthur and I killed him and he died. And then the epilogue starts, and you can feel it coming because you know that it has not closed off the storyline. And so, you know, I knew that this was coming, and also I knew that it was going to have to draw the storyline around to the start of Red Dead Redemption 1, which of course happens after the events of Red Dead Redemption 2.
Does Arthur look up to the sky at one point, spit his tobacco out and goes, "It looks like we got an epilogue coming." There's an epilogue blowing in.
Yeah. I can hear it on the wind. And I'm going, yeah. And also, sorry, Arthur, for everything I put you through. And then he dies. Yeah. So you spend the epilogue playing as John Marston. And there's, you know, it is largely very successful. It has to do quite a lot because it has to. So at the end of Arthur's storyline, John Marston and his family have finally run away from the bad gang that they've been running in all this time, with the threat of them being followed or, you know, repercussions. John Marston is actually left for dead. Do we know whether he survived at the end of before Arthur dies? I can't remember. But anyway, his wife and kid is saved. And that's kind of Arthur's last redemptive act before he carks it. And we have to get from there with Marston coming back, reuniting with them and setting him up as a family man, sort of on a life of straight and narrow. And then set up him being arrested by the government and having to be a bad boy again for Red Dead Redemption 1. That's quite a lot to do for a fucking epilogue. Keep playing as a whole new character, you know, but also satisfying a player who has invested a huge amount in a character that is now dead. You know, by, you know, satisfying what all they've invested, there are all of the challenges that the game is setting you about by hunting and shooting stuff. There's Arthur's notebook, which he's been drawing these beautiful pictures in throughout the game. There's the kind of the gun collection he's got. There are all the side missions and things that he may or may not have finished. There's so much going on, and Red Dead Redemption 2 wisely knows that as an open world game, it really shouldn't be dictating to the player, you know, what they now can and can't do. And he has to do that in a consistent way while also handing off to a new character with a new storyline with lots of rules about where that storyline has to end, because it has to kind of dovetail with the older story. I'd say it pretty much does it. And it does it in the most lavish, insanely lavish way. You know, I think that Red Dead Redemption 1, 2 was the most expensive game developed by that point, like $500 million or something like that, with thousands of people, you know, 1,000 developers working on it. All of the kind of the problems of sort of crunch and other things that came with it that were, you know, widely reported at the time back in 2018. It's whole new mechanics are introduced in the epilogue. You have a new base, you have a farmhouse which you are building from scratch, like, you know, making much choice, like it's all story built stuff, but like you are, like there are all these new animations of you kind of setting fences back together, erecting, you know, putting down kind of foundations, wooden foundations for a ranch house, and got all sorts of things. There's new gangs, enemy gangs that are introduced. The Skinner family, a whole new gang, and then there's a whole new area. The map expands probably another third in scale westwards. Ridiculous. Yeah. Out to Armadillo, which is the town that you start, or at least that's, you know, which is the kind of the central town at the start of Red Dead Redemption 1. It's all there. There's kind of, if you go around the world, because the storyline jumps ahead in time by 5 or 10 years or something over the course of the epilogue from the start to end, there are new buildings that pop up. There's, you know, the world is kind of aging with the storyline. And this is all there, whether you even, you know, even notice it, whether you get to this stage in the game. 37% of players actually got through it all. It's probably another 6 or 7 hours of play. It's just extraordinary. It's insane. Absolutely insane. And it's just about successful. Like, I was relieved that it's finished. The credits, just the credits. So if you haven't had enough story by this point, I think that you've played over 100 story missions by this time. If you haven't, and, you know, across the epilogue and the main game, if you hadn't had enough story by now, it has not finished yet. And you want to see this stuff, because during the main sort of pre, you know, main credits, what would you call them? The pre-credits, the chonky credits. It's doing these, you know, in between sort of every other kind of title card, you get these animated sequences, you know, in engine and sequences showing the world. There might be just little vignettes of the world, beautiful little kind of scenes, trains going by and birds doing stuff. And sometimes they are showing what's happened next. And this is the bit where you see the government agents investigating crimes, what you've done, and you know that they're going to trace you down, and that will lead to the start of Red Dead Redemption 1. This is that these credits last at least half an hour. It's probably 45 minutes. And that's before the scrolling ones, which I did skip. I don't know how long those last. Absolutely bewilderingly just big. Big sky country. Big America. Big, I mean, what more fitting kind of ending to a game about big America than a big epilogue. Good God.
Yes, the American story of endless post-credit sequences. Yeah. Truly, we are living in the American post-credit sequence.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, quite stunning. I'm glad I lived through it. And I'm glad I can finally get rid of this 100 and something gigabyte game off my PlayStation 5 hard drive, because it's wheezing in there and I need to deliver it.
Well, it looks like
I've not finished that game.
This game needs a shooting.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting. I mean, I only played the first sort of third of that game, I think. So thank you for spoiling it for me, because now I don't have to play it.
Sorry.
No, I'm joking. I was never going to play it. It's fine. I was never going to play it. I was good to hear it. I literally, my preferred way of experiencing that is by you, rather than having to play through the whole thing. But it's interesting, because I do think with AAA games, and AAA games that feature narrative to such a huge component. You know, a lot of people are playing the new Final Fantasy game at the moment, you know, which is a big bastard role-playing game with huge amounts of story. Story that, you know, to a great extent, people know where it's going. You know, it's a kind of fascinating narrative form that that's taking. But in AAA and in AAA narrative, I think there aren't that many knockout success stories in terms of like a storytelling experience for the player. And I think there's like loads of reasons for that. I think there's, you know, I think there's lots of reasons for that. But what I sort of think is the way to moderate against those reasons, the ways to moderate against your story feeling overextended or thin or unbelievable, if you're trying to track a player through many, many tens of hours of game and have a story that lives and breathes alongside that play, which is a really, really difficult thing to do well, I think, is characters, right? It's if you have characters which feel real and feel like their relationships to each other are realistic and vivid and full of kind of life, then I think players are willing to kind of accept anything, really. And like, I played enough of Red Dead Redemption 2 to know that the characters in that game are almost universally just inspired in how they're conceived, how they're drawn, how they're written. The relationships they have with each other are complicated. Nothing boils down to a kind of simple tagline or word even, which you often get in AAA games. You often get characters like, this is the angry guy, this is the brave guy, this is the sexy lady. And like, not there's anything wrong with those things, but what if they were all the same person? You know, like, and I think Red Dead Redemption 2 is just, I think what Rockstar do really well, even when they put it to the purposes of like pure evil in a Grand Theft Auto, you know, 5 type way, is build these characters that just inspire play, and they paper over all sorts of dodgy cracks with regards to like, yeah, how to keep a story singing through, you know, through the fact that you like walked away and came back to that game several times over half a decade, and it still felt like a substantive experience.
Yeah,
it's so remarkable.
It's
right?
Quite interesting what you're saying, because one of the game is very intent on reminding you about the kind of the headlines. It's very, I mean, I'd say it's good at doing it. It is kind of discernible a lot of the time.
Well, it looks like you've been skinning lots of alligators there. Yeah. Have you tried out the mini games yet? We got some microtransactions.
Have you tried cleaning your drone guns recently? No, it's the it's the gang. What's his name? The main gang leader.
Dutch.
Thank you. I should remember
Dutch.
This, really.
Yeah, I haven't even played it.
Dutch is very, like, he will, in most of his scenes, he will remind you, give you the headlines of where he's at. So, and the headlines kind of, they're almost act-based, you know. So, at the start, he's talking, we're a big family. We're all like each other. You know, did I keep you all together? You all look up to me. And the next one is like, things aren't going so well, but you just listen to me and we'll all come through this fine. And then by the end of it, like, you know, the headlines are, you know, you're not following me. You're against me rather than you're undermining the family that I built. You're going back on me. But the thing is that when you play a few missions with him back to back, you get the headlines over and over again. And that basically you have to do that with a game like this because there will be lots of people like me who've literally not met Dutch in 6 months, and getting a kind of a reminder of what's going on is kind of useful. But it's also like, I think there is a lot of richness in the Rockstar way of doing things, but they are also they do archetypes well, but they don't take things deeper than the archetypes. Do you know what I mean? Like, sort of, no one's really going to surprise you. Do you know what I mean? That I don't know. Maybe I'm not surprised because, I'm talking myself around again.
Well, it's tricky, isn't it? Because it's a cowboy story, right? Which is a story based on an invented idea of the relatively recent past, right? Like, and I know that in Red Dead, they were like, no, we did lots of research and we like tried to like portray it as a kind of realism, realism cowboys. But we're a long way off realistic, right? Mm. This is a genre essentially based on American movies, and the American movies were based on an idealized version of...
Yeah, that's very true.
Like a creation myth, right? That's what cowboy movies are, isn't it? It's a creation myth for America, which is founded in the very American ideal of shooting people and ethnically cleansing people in order to, stake your claim on a land as God has mandated it. And like Red Dead Redemption is very canny and is an inversion of that, right? It's about the death of it's the cowboy movie you make now, right? It's Unforgiven.
Yep, absolutely.
It's the story about how that dream dies and falls apart, which is all well and good. But because you are telling a story of archetypes and about the falsity of archetypes in this myth making, you are also subject to the archetypal nature of them. And I think they do a good job of making those archetypes feel real, you know? But I do agree with you that, like, the world has to do a lot of heavy lifting there as well, because,
No, it is stunning. It is I didn't really want to leave it because even all those months, all those years and all those hours of actual play later, like that world, just the light, it looks stunning still.
Absolutely. Yeah, still looks gorgeous, doesn't it? For a game that's half a decade old and it still absolutely shines. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But some of the best mud. And the best mud ever in a game, and some of the best horse testicles ever in a game.
Very much so, and horse shitting. Yeah,
love it. Mm. okay, well, that's about all the time we've got for this episode of the Crate and Crowbar. You can hang out with us and our community on our Discord, a link for which is on our website, crateandcrowbar.com. The Crate and Crowbar is kindly funded by our Patreon backers. If you'd like to know more about supporting our podcast and its various spin-off, that's www.patreon.com/crateandcrowbar. All that leaves me to say is good night from me. I've been Jamie Britton.
And it's a good night from me. I've been Alex Wilshire.
Thank you very much for listening, everyone. Everybody.